It's a topic that pretty much sells itself. Maybe that's why it gets plastered all over glossy magazine covers and why pictures and videos of it are the very backbone of the internet. Give the people what they want, right? But maybe tons of sex all the time isn't what people really want. They just think they're supposed to want that and that everyone else is already having that, so it'd be weird if they weren't into it. Sex is used to sell us pretty much everything from toothbrushes to cars. But our guest today says that that isn't the kind of sex most people really care about or want to have, and images of it can leave us feeling frustrated and inadequate. She spent years talking with young people, mostly in their 20s, about their personal lives. We're talking intimate details. Her new book is called The Sex Myth: The Gap Between Our Fantasies and Reality. It sizes up the situation by weaving philosophical critique with very personal anecdotes. The author is an Australian journalist who now lives in New York. Her work has been published widely on the web and in print and on her blog, The Musings of an Inappropriate Woman, which has more than 100,000 subscribers. The Sex Myth is the first book by Rachel Hills, and we are beyond pleased to be discussing it with her in the studio today. Rachel Hills, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me, Emily.
It's my pleasure. Like I was telling you before the interview, I really did enjoy reading this book. It strikes me that it must have taken you years. Can you tell us how many that was, and how many people's experiences are we going to be talking about today?
So the book took me somewhere between 6 and 8 years to research and write, depending on how you count it. I started thinking about the ideas in it back in around 2007, and then obviously now it's 2015 and the book just came out. While I was researching it, I spoke to a couple of hundred people, as you said, most of them aged in their 20s, and they were living in the US, in the UK, in Canada, in Australia. Those were the primary countries, and there were a few Europeans thrown in there as well. But I also spent many years looking at other people's social science literature and the history and all that kind of stuff to try to create this picture of what it is that we believe about sex now, where that comes from, and then how that impacts people on a day-to-day level.
And so the age range, mostly people in their 20s, what was the actual range there and why did you choose this generation?
So the age range was about 16 to 32. And the main reason, and obviously these people have all aged since I interviewed them. So some of the people may have been 24.
We tend to do that, don't we?
Some of them might have been 24 when I interviewed them and 30 now, or 17 when I interviewed them and 20 now. So, but I was capturing them at that point in their lives. And the reason I chose to focus on that age group is mostly because I was so young when I came up with the idea for the book. So I was 25 when I started developing the idea of the sex myth. And at that time, there was so much kind of hysteria and moral panic around young people's sexual behavior. And, you know, there still is, and perhaps there was before, but at 25, you really notice it because you're in the thick of it. And at that time in particular, there was this huge focus on hookup culture, this idea that 20-somethings and teenagers were having more sex than ever before, and that this was both a really terrible thing, but also something that was really titillating. And that definitely did not reflect my life at the time, and I came to realize it wasn't reflecting other people's as well, and that there was this ideal that was being presented that was hurting people. And I thought that I wanted to investigate that ideal. And also, even though I, like my interviewees, have aged while writing it, I wanted to write a book that was about young people's experiences and speaking to them rather than a book that was treating young people as an object of study. So kind of like a for us, by us kind of thing.
Yeah. And I think I really want to unpack some of the paradoxes in this book, like a hookup culture of people who aren't actually really hooking up that much. At the heart of the book we're talking about today, the sex myth, it seems like there's this notion that our ideas about sex are not so biological after all, that they are products of our particular time and our place. Before we talk about the here and now, did you research the past for this book, and did you find so-called norms that would appear ridiculous today that were contextualized in their time and place totally normal?
Well, it's funny because I think there's this tendency to tell the story of progress when it comes to history. Or I guess maybe if you're a progressive. If you're not a progressive, maybe it's a story of horrible decline. But we tend to think of the past as being very different to the world that we live in now. And, you know, even though the story that I tell in the book is a story primarily about now, the more I dig into history, the more I realize that things have actually changed less than we think they have, rather than more. So, as I said, I was inspired to write the book partly because of the moral panics around young people and sex. But towards the end of my research, I came across this wonderful, to me, because I thought it was hilarious, 1964 article, which was published in Time magazine about the effects of the sexual revolution. And all their concerns, they were talking about champagne parties for 12-year-olds or padded brassieres. And I thought, this is exactly, not so much in the US, but in Australia, where I was from, this was a major social concern a couple of years ago. So there are those parallels. And of course, there were marital sex guides in the 1920s. So it's not like we're radically different now than we have been.
Yeah, I think one of the figures that gets batted around a lot, and I would argue maybe in a way to sometimes shame the wrong people, but the teen birth rate of all time versus the teen birth rate now. Did you look at that?
I did not. Have you looked at it?
No, I don't know how one would go about knowing the teen birth rate of all time, but I mean, some of our greatest works of literature center around teen mothers, and they're not even, it's not a big deal because that's kind of just how it was done, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do know, even though I don't have the statistics in front of me, that the teen birth rate has actually gone down over the past couple of decades, which is, you know, due to at least good sex education for some people and availability of contraception and, you know, just general knowledge about sex.
And your book, The Sex Myth, you really it does in some ways read like it could be required reading for sex ed. Maybe you're not there yet.
So my dad said when he read it, he said, put this in high schools. And I thought, I think my reader is a little older than 15, but, you know, that's good.
Well, maybe 15-year-olds do the same thing that the rest of us tend to do, which is to assume everyone is having better and more sex than you. Did you find that with the... was it something like over 200 interviews that you did for this book? Was that a consensus among people?
I think the kinds of people that volunteer to be interviewed for a book like this, they tend to be quite critically minded people. So they weren't necessarily buying into this idea that everybody is having sex constantly and that it's really great. But, you know, they're a little smarter than that. And I think most of us are, that you can be critical of that ideal and still on some level feel like you should be doing something different to what you are. And the area in which people may feel inadequate is going to be different for each person.
Yeah, or maybe even internalize ideas that you know are kind of stupid.
Exactly.
I want to talk more about that after a short break. We're here in the studio with Rachel Hill. She's the author of The Sex Myth, The Gap Between Our Fantasies and Reality. I'm your host today, Emily Curitan, and we would love to hear from you on the topic of the sex myth. How much sex do you have and not have, and how does that make you feel? Phone number is 800-838-3760 or email us jx@jeffnet.org. We'll be back with Rachel Hills on the flip side of a very short break. Back on the Jefferson Exchange, I'm Emily Curitan. We're here in the studio with Rachel Hills, author of The Sex Myth. You can give us a call, 800-838-3760, or email jx@jeffnet.org. Now, Rachel, we were just talking about the over 200 interviews you did in the writing of this book with people between, say, 16 and their early 30s. They've all aged like now, as we all are at every moment of every day. You must have asked these people some really intimate questions. Did you have to pry them open, or once you asked about their sex lives, did they just sort of like gush, you know?
I think I'd say they more gushed than needed to be pried open. And partly that's because people volunteered to talk to me. But I also think there's a certain appeal because on one hand, we talk about sex constantly in our culture, as you mentioned at the beginning of this interview. But on the other hand, there are quite comparatively few opportunities to talk about the aspects of your sex life that might make you feel uncomfortable or that you might feel awkward about, or to be kind of brutally honest. So I think the idea of sitting down with a stranger who, yes, is going to record what you say and type it down and possibly put it into a book, but who you may never have to see again. There's a certain appeal about that kind of honesty. It's like seeing a therapist in a way.
A kind of catharsis.
Exactly.
Uh-huh. And in terms of what they told you, really the heart of this book, did you already have your kind of thesis of the sex myth? And I am eventually going to ask you what that is. But did you already have your thesis worked out before you talked to these 200 some odd people and then they confirmed it? Or was it really a process of discovery?
It was a process of discovery, but a lot of that discovery was not solely through the interviews. So I didn't spend the entire 8 years interviewing people. I spent probably 3 to 6. I can't remember. I went back and interviewed people again. But my thesis was my argument was drawn together from a lot of the research I did on other people's research. So it was all that time spent reading the sociologists on it, reading the philosophers on it, reading the historians, and kind of pulling together both their studies and their ideas to develop my idea of the sex myth.
You do mention quite a few philosophers in the book. Could you talk more about how modern philosophy informed your take on this kind of lowbrow is the word that jumped to mind, but it's not a lowbrow topic, but some of the representations of it that perhaps most influence us are. We're getting them from cable television or from glossy magazine covers. How did you integrate like critical theory with pop culture?
It's a good question. I guess I feel like those two things aren't necessarily incompatible at all. And I think that if you're somebody who is critically engaging with the world and thinking about your experiences and thinking about what you're consuming, then philosophy or sociology is a really useful way to do that. And for me, those two kind of fields did overlap. So a lot of my early thinking, this is a bit nerdy and academic, so I probably won't go into it too deeply, but looking at a whole bunch of sociologists, particularly in Britain, but also here in New York, US, who have worked on thinking about these stories or these scripts that we're told about sex. So that was very influential for me. And then after I'd been reading that stuff for a couple of years, I discovered Michel Foucault, who, of course, I quote at the very beginning of the book. And I think that his quote really kind of sums up my message, which is, my point is not that everything is bad, but that everything is dangerous. So, i.e., when it comes to sex, I'm not saying that our sexual culture at the moment is absolutely terrible and needs to be changed. I'm just saying that it's not perfect and there are these political things going on there.
You used some words there that I want to follow up on. One of them was scripts, these scripts that are being written about our sexual narrative as a society. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, sure. So there is this idea in sociology of social scripts. And I guess it's an idea that's fundamental to socialization. So that as we are humans going through the world, starting out as babies and then as children and as adults, a lot of the way that we learn about how the world works is not through directly being taught, but it's through observation. And it's through this reiteration of the same stories or slight variations on the same stories over and over again. And so one of the things that they call these are social scripts, and they operate on a number of different levels. There are the intrapsychic or internalized scripts, which are the stories that we're telling ourselves. Then there are the interpersonal scripts. So as I'm interacting with you, we both have certain ideas of how a radio program is supposed to unfold.
As do our listeners.
Yeah, as do our listeners. And then on the bigger level, there are the social scripts. So the stories that our culture is telling us. And I found that framework just really useful to look at. So what I try to do in the book is I look at, well, what are the stories that our culture is telling us? And then how do we enact those stories in our interactions with each other? And not just in sexual relationships, but in the way that we talk to each other in conversation, I think is equally important. And then how do those stories then shape the stories that we then tell ourselves about our own lives and our own minds?
This idea of a script is an interesting one, especially as it relates to sex. another thing, that a word that has come up in this conversation so far is consumption. How do we consume sex without actually having it?
That's a really interesting question. And I think it's, yeah, what do we even do with that? How do we consume sex? I think it's through partly the imagery that you referred to at the beginning. And it's the fact that, firstly, when we talk about sex, we're not just talking about the very narrow kind of physical act that most of us define as being sex, by which I mean penetrative intercourse between a man and a woman. We're talking about a whole range of kind of physical acts. But we're also talking about a range of different emotional acts as well. So we're talking about this feeling of desire or our sense of our own desirability or our value. What else are we thinking about?
You talk to a lot of women in the book who seem to have really linked their worth, their self-worth, to not only their sexual desirability, but their sexual availability. Like, if they are young and committed, then people won't like them, or they won't like themselves, I think, is a scarier thing. Is that an accurate characterization?
Kind of. So you're saying that if they're in a committed relationship, then that's not part of the script, to go back to the word that we were using
before. Being young and free and doing whatever you
want. Being young and free. And I think that is, to some degree, a script that applies to both men and women. But it was interesting to me that women seemed to much more closely monitor themselves in terms of how they were fitting to that script or not. And when I think about it, it really makes sense, because I think that female sexuality and the way that women engage with sex is monitored by everyone else. So why wouldn't we monitor ourselves? But in terms of your question of are they aspiring to be sexually available, I don't know that availability is the right word, because it kind of suggests that it's about being available to other people. And I think that it's, in some ways, it's a much more internalized thing. It's not just about wanting to be available to others. It's about wanting to be a certain type of person who is independent and in control of their life and fun and vibrant. And being sexual is a big part of that story.
We're talking with Rachel Hills about her book, The Sex Myth, The Gap Between Our Fantasies and Reality. It's a new book, and we'd love to have your take on this discussion, as well as what you think about sex, how it's portrayed in the media, how that makes you feel. Have you ever embellished your own sex life and then wondered, why did I just do that? We want to hear from you. 800-838-3760 or email us jx@jeffnet.org. Rachel, we're talking about these scripts that it's the word we're using for a narrative that goes beyond an individual person's story. It's something that gets repeated over and over, almost a cliche at some point. I think we alluded to some of those earlier. It seems like the age of social media and the internet would have opened these narratives up to a lot of different voices. Do you think that's having its own brand of sexual revolution in the online world, or what effect does that have?
I think it could be. And I think that it is something that is already happening. So there are many things involved in this idea of the sex myth, but part of it is this idea that there's this monolithic right way to be doing sex. Or if there's not one way, there are a handful of ways, and that will differ depending on how old you are, your gender, your ethnicity, who you hang out with, etc. And I think what the internet is already doing is it's starting to take away some of the power of those stories. So I remember, even back when I was first researching the book, reading a few articles on the website Jezebel, which I remember kind of created this kind of great emotional excitement in me, partly because they were challenging what it meant to be a sexually free or sexually liberated young woman, but also just reading all the comments and all the smart things that readers had to say, and how when they were drawing upon their own experiences, they were challenging these kind of narrow ideas of how sex should be. And I think the internet has already been powerful in that, and that if we're going to deconstruct this idea that there's one way to be sexual, that the internet will probably continue to be powerful in doing that.
I mean, I could see it going both ways, where it's sort of this force for egalitarianism, where all these people have voices and you're like, oh, I'm not weird, or at least there's a lot of other people who are just as weird as me.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's kind of a cacophony of of more narratives to measure yourself against. Do you see did you hear that from people that you talked to, or did the internet come up when they talked about sex? Did things like Facebook and Twitter and social media and the way that it affected their sex lives, was that a theme at the time that you did these interviews?
Not as much as you would expect, which was really surprising because I did the bulk of the interviews in 2012. And that was a time when the moral panic around young people and sex du jour was based on the internet. I guess as it is now.
Like
that, if
it's so easy to just, I can just message someone and then.
Yeah, or, you know, internet pornography shaping people's sexual experiences. And it was almost surprising to me how little that came up in interviews rather than how much. I think social media, obviously it can be a source of anxiety for many people because it kind of allows you to measure how much people like you or how much people like what you have to say. It's kind of this wonderful but also awful in a way window into what other people think of you. But I think maybe sex can be kind of hidden enough that I'm not sure that it's public in a social media sense.
And earlier, we were focusing on technology here. Earlier, though, when I asked you about history, you said that things have changed perhaps less than we might be inclined to think. In your book, you write that sex doesn't need to be actively suppressed to be controlled. Could you talk more about that?
Yeah, sure. That's a big question. Sex doesn't need to actively be repressed in order to be controlled. And that is a really central kind of theme of the book. Because one of the questions that I was setting out to answer when I was writing it was, well, how is sex controlled today? And I think that there is a tendency that, particularly if you're on the more progressive end of the spectrum, that when you're thinking about sexual control, you think about all the things that we're told we should not be doing. And there are still legions of these, particularly depending on, as I said, the social circles that you move in. So we're still told that it's better to be monogamous than to not be monogamous or to have sex with a few people. I think, you know, even though there's now marriage equality in the United States, we're still told that it's better to be straight than to be gay. Or at least the message is, you are straight until proven otherwise.
Or this idea of normal, I think, is where I'd like to go next.
Yeah.
The definition of normal is still kind of based around a pretty narrow sexuality or sexual experience. Could you talk about that?
But sure, I was going to say, in terms of regulation and it not just being a form of control, what I wanted to look at in the book is not just what we're told not to do, but what we're told to do, and how we're told that sex is this incredibly central thing to our desirability, to our relationships, to our health, to our enlightenment, and then how this also creates anxiety amongst many people feeling like they're not being sexual enough, and how that's a form of control in and of itself, even though it appears to be the opposite of what we traditionally think of as being control.
And did you feel these anxieties yourself?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's a large part of why I wrote the book. Oh, it was part of my initial impetus to start exploring the subject anyway. And I think I felt both of those twin pressures going in both directions at the same time.
And in writing the book, did you feel like this weight lift off of you? Are those pressures still there? You still live in the same old world here.
Well, I think that, you know, it took me 8 years to write the book, so I naturally change a bit over time anyway. So I certainly feel it less acutely than I did when I was 25. But I still, I feel an awareness of the aspects of what it means to have a good sex life or to be a good sexual person that I don't personally live up to. Like, I'm aware that on that level that I'm not doing what society is telling me that I should be doing. And I wouldn't say I cry into my pillow about it ever, but I do sometimes have this more maybe internally high-pitched anxiety. Like, oh, I'm not being a good woman. I'm not doing the right things.
Uh-huh. And but you're not alone, it turns out.
That's, no, definitely not alone.
That's what we learn in the sex myth. Your new book, hundreds of interviews condensed into here. A central word for me when I think about sex and deviance is this word normal.
Mm-hmm.
Can we talk about that? What is normal, and what did the people you interviewed think was normal? Is there a normal?
Well, it's funny because as we've talked about, most of the people that I interviewed tended to be younger. So many of them were in their 20s or their early 30s or some teenagers. And they broadly constitute the kind of millennial generation. And I feel like one of, if not the norms, but maybe the ethics that our generation aspire to and that we try to live is this idea that everything is normal. So we like to think of ourselves as being very accepting people. So whenever I asked people what normal was, they would always say, everything is normal, everything's accepted. And then I would ask them, okay, well, what isn't accepted? And then they would be able to list many, many things that were not accepted from, for example, the age at which you have sex. You shouldn't be younger than, say, 15 or 16, or people will treat you as if you're weird or morally corrupt. But you also shouldn't be older than 18 or 20, or people will be like, why haven't you gotten it over and done yet? Mm-hmm. It's still considered weird to be kinky or to be non-monogamous. But it's also considered weird in other quarters to prefer the missionary position. Or it's considered weird if you're in a relationship where you don't have sex several times a week. Or the fact that we still count sex as being that kind of penetrative intercourse, even though you could have a very loving, sensual, you know, orgasmic relationship and not be having penetrative sex all the time.
And did people get hung up on the amount of times that they were supposed to have sex in a given period of time? Did you hear like an average there?
I did hear that from a few women in particular, which I think is due to the fact that women have so much lifestyle media targeted at us. And they give us very kind of monolithic idea of how we should be having sex, which every woman would say, you know, 2 to 3 times a week. And this wasn't just something that straight women told me either. One of my favorite stories in the book, which was from somebody here in Oregon, actually, she was a young lesbian woman, and she talked about how this idea of lesbian bed death was kind of really influential in her community.
Lesbian bed death?
Yeah, so this fear, it's this idea, it's a concept that was created in the 1980s to describe what they perceived as being a fact that lesbian women had less sex in long-term relationships than heterosexual couples. And so amongst this young woman and her friends, there was this fear that if you were having less sex in your relationship, then you were about to enter lesbian bed death. And so she told the story about how firstly she would check how often she was having sex against her friends. And then sometimes if she was with a girlfriend, they'd check in and they'd be like, we haven't had sex in 2 weeks. What's going on? And then they would both cry. And I found it funny because I thought, so would I would do if I was in a relationship with a woman.
That's not one of the narratives that we hear too much in these glossy magazines. It's interesting to be studying young people's sex lives. I think a sequel to this book with the same people in 30 years, 20 years would be pretty compelling stuff. We're going to be talking more about the sex myth, the gap between our fantasies and reality, with the author, Rachel Hills. It's her first book. She's an Australian journalist, did a reading at Bloomsbury Books here in Ashland last night, and was kind enough to stop by the JPR studios and discuss this new book with us. We'd love to get your phone calls and emails on the other side of a short break. Phone number, as always, is 800-838-3760, or you can talk to us on the internets at jx@jeffnet.org. I'm Emily Curitan, hosting for Jeffrey Riley today. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Emily Curitan, producer of the show. I'm in the host hot seat today, and I have been pushing that phone number pretty hard because I love to hear from you. I'm normally on the other side of the glass taking your calls. We are talking about the sex myth today, some paradoxes and ironies about the feelings that we have about sex in a very sex-saturated culture. You can take part, 800-838-3760, or email us, jx@jeffnet.org. Now, Rachel Hills, we've been talking about this book, The Sex Myth. It just came out. It struck a chord with me, I'll be honest, because I think I definitely grew up in a time where there was a tension between this religion that was everywhere. I grew up in Texas. I'll just reveal that. And then you turn on the TV and you have shows where you've got these 14-year-olds who were like sexual masters, you know, choosing their partners. in interviewing people for your book, you mentioned that you talked to folks from all over the world. Did religion play a role for everyone or for anyone?
I think it played a bigger role in the United States than it did in the other countries that I visited.
And what did people, how did it come up? Would you ask them directly about religion when you talked about sex, or would they bring it up?
They would bring it up. So I think firstly, it kind of hung over most people's heads in the United States when I was talking to them, whether they were religious or not. Religion was a factor when they were thinking about these lessons of how you should be sexual and how you should not be, even if it wasn't something they were personally following. And I think that's because religion is so much part of the cultural and political discourse around sex in the US. Things such as, even though we now have marriage equality, same-sex marriage is still this very fraught thing. And issues like reproductive rights are as well. And obviously many young people in the United States, almost regardless of where in the country they are, they grow up being told, don't have sex until you're married.
You can't get married if you're gay.
Yeah, and you can't get married if you're gay.
So you can never have sex.
Yeah, that is definitely part of the implicit lesson there. But it was interesting to me that despite what feminists call purity culture, which is this idea that women in particular should definitely not be having sex until they're married, that wasn't necessarily what the Americans I interviewed were aspiring to in their own lives. So it was quite, even though religion played a big role, it wasn't what the young women or the young men I was interviewing, they weren't saying, most of them weren't aspiring to wait until marriage. That was definitely a minority thing.
It seems like the narratives that we're told about sexuality, in particular about heterosexuality and homosexuality, they can really go all over the map. In your book, I remember a part where you talk about coming out these days for a lot of young people isn't the anguishing thing that it used to be. Did you get a sense of how that, you know, what the range is there on people's experiences that you interviewed?
Yeah, so there are a couple of stories I share in the book, one from a young American man and one from a young British woman. And I share both their coming out stories, and they're very different from each other for a bunch of different reasons. So the young American man who grew up in Massachusetts, just outside of Boston, for him, coming out was a really scary thing. Like, he was literally pulled out of the closet, and he was so distressed when this happened. It was such a psychological break for him that he hospitalized himself for several days as a way of dealing with it. Like, he just had a complete breakdown because it was just such an affront to his identity to actually be seen in that way and to go back to what we were talking about before, abnormal. And he was 27 at the time I interviewed him, which I guess would make him about 30 now.
And his actual coming out, he just changed his status on social media, right?
But yeah, he did it in a casual way. So internally, it was this big, terrifying change that he'd already come out as being bisexual, and he'd had this long-term girlfriend through high school. And when he was in his 20s, he was out with her one night, and this other guy that she'd been flirting with when they'd split up for a brief time, he came and basically pushed this guy, Edward, around and said, "You're gay." And Edward knew that he was gay, but the fact that he was recognized in that way by other people was terrifying. So internally, this absolute moment of terror, but then he didn't want to confront it with other people. So as you say, he just went and changed his status on MySpace and hid away from the world because he didn't want to have the discussion.
Mm. And in your consideration of the differences between people who are navigating the world as hetero or as homosexual, did you trace back the origins of those words, where we get them from?
Yeah. So they were both words that were invented, I believe, around the turn of the 20th century. And they were both created to describe ways of being deviant. So even though later in the 20th century, there was this idea that to be homosexual was deviant, but to be heterosexual was kind of good and upstanding and normal. In each of their inventions, they were both treated as forms of being abnormal. So homosexuality was used to describe somebody who had this dirty sexual attraction to the same sex, and heterosexual was used to describe somebody who had this untoward and dirty attraction to people of the opposite sex.
So both were negative.
They were both negative.
To describe some kind of abnormality. What would have been the word?
Or if not necessarily abnormal, because I guess most people are homosexual, heterosexual, really both. Most people have this dirty attraction going on. But I guess maybe if not I guess deviance isn't just about being abnormal, is it? It's not about being statistically abnormal. It's about failing to meet that script.
On this topic of sexuality, and I suspect we might get into gender a bit and have to unpack the difference, we do have a caller who's been waiting on the line very patiently. Jean in Winston, you are on the air. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, thank you. I have two questions. One is, are there people who really are both hetero and homosexual, like they like to be like the man or the woman, and they're equally attracted to men and women? And then my other question is, do you think that children from an early age should be encouraged to decide which sex they want to be or identify as? So thank you.
Thanks for those questions, Jean.
Thank you. Those are big questions. The first one is easier for me to answer. Yes, there are absolutely people who are both who are attracted to both men and women. And I think that there are probably even more people who are attracted to both men and women in our society than who acknowledge it, because we still live in a society that, well, at least when I was growing up, it might be different for people who are 5 or 10 or 15 today. But I grew up surrounded by images of little girls falling in love with little boys and women marrying men, and you learn that that is how sex works and that's how attraction works. And I think of, there was a bisexual woman I interviewed for the book who talked about how she almost found it easier to recognize her attraction with men because she'd learnt what attraction to men felt like, and she'd learnt to identify those feelings as being attraction. But in terms of her attraction to women, she'd been learnt to think of those feelings as just admiring a woman or just feeling friendship. So she always had to kind of take pause to understand that. So I think our society definitely channels us towards being heterosexual, and that if we didn't do that so much, more people would be able to explore the potential of being attracted to both genders.
And I think the second part of Jean's question there might relate to more to an earlier segment in the show we had with a medical director for a trans youth center talking about the advantages to children who have nonconforming gender identities transitioning early. Do you have anything to add on that question about how young are we equipped? What we talked about earlier was people making decisions about their gender. Now we're talking about making decisions about your sexuality. And I think the difference there is important. Do you encounter that confusion? Do you have anything to add there?
I think that I'm now of the age where people I know are starting to have kids. And it's been interesting watching people that I know raise their kids. And I don't think it's a matter of choosing a gender. Can a 5-year-old choose their gender? Maybe, maybe not. But I think what I see a lot of parents doing now is allowing their kids to wear the clothes that they want or to like the things that they like without necessarily attaching a gender label to that. And then as the child grows older, they can then choose a gender.
Does the sex myth tend to sexualize children?
The sex myth sexualized children. I don't know. I don't think so.
I was just thinking, you made me think of kind of how disturbing one of the narratives here of the little girls dressed up in clothes that were tailored to be provocative on an adult body, or you know, there's a lot of examples of it where, as a little girl, very early on, you're kind of keyed in to making yourself attractive or seem a certain way, seem like a sexual entity.
That's true. I mean, now that you mention it, it reminds me of the study that I reference in the book that took place in Illinois, and they were interviewing elementary school-aged girls about their interests, and they thought that they'd be talking to these girls about dance or, you know, about ponies or something. And these girls, they might be 7 or 8, but what they all wanted to talk to the researchers about was boys. And that study was so interesting to me because it showed how sexual socialization starts at such an early age, which is different to sexualization. And I think it's important then when I talk about this study to say that these girls, they were engaging at with, you know, the idea of sexuality in a very age appropriate kind of way. They weren't fantasizing about having sex, and even kissing seemed kind of gross. Definitely something you should leave to
a teenager. But they were crushing.
They were crushing. And it goes back to what I was saying about how we learn heterosexuality and we learn sexuality at such a young age. Because I bet you all those little girls in the classroom, they're not all going to grow up to be straight. But at age 6, 7, 8, 9, they have learned that the proper kind of target for crushes is boys, and that boys are exciting and the crushes are exciting. heading.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we've been talking a lot this morning with Rachel Hills about the sex myth, her new book. Jean brought up a great point, our caller, about the fluidity of sexuality and how, but while the script word we've introduced this hour, the narrative in society is often pretty binary. You're either you're gay or you're straight, you're male or you're female. When we think about where these ideas come from, I imagine a newsstand with glossy magazines on it and the covers of which will have things like how to please your man or bring it up a notch, spice it down, spice it up, whatever they say. I never buy them. I think you've actually written for...
I've written for a lot of them, actually.
You've written for a lot of them. Are those kinds of things inherently political? They seem sort of frivolous when you're in the checkout stand, but...
I think they're absolutely political, and that's why I started writing for women's magazines in the first place, because when I was a young reader, 18, 19, I was reading them and I saw them as sites for discussion around gender and around feminism, and as someone who wanted to write around those issues, to me, writing for women's magazines seemed like a natural place to do that.
And the audiences of those magazines, I would imagine, are a bit younger. Your book seems geared towards the people it's about, which is millennials. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, obviously, I've had Gen Xers read it and really like it. My parents are baby boomers. I mean, they are related to me. But
that's my next question, actually, is how did your parents and your grandparents respond to this book? Did it facilitate a conversation maybe you hadn't had?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, obviously, because the book took me such a long time to write, I spoke to my parents throughout the process of writing it. And so I remember having some very funny conversations early on when I introduced them to the concept of PIV, which is a term that's used online to describe penis and vagina sex, mm-hmm. and to differentiate it from other forms. And my parents thought this was just absolutely hilarious. And they're like, PIN, penis and nose, or PIE, penis and eye.
Or penis and ears.
Yeah, penis and ear. Exactly. Uh-huh. So we had those kinds of conversations. The conversation we have not had yet, and maybe I hope we never have it, is a couple of weeks ago I had an essay published in the New York Times when I revealed the age at which I first had sex. And it's, you know, it's confronting enough having that out there, but the people I was most embarrassed about potentially reading that were my parents. And I'm sure they have read it, but I don't really want to talk to them about it.
Yeah, so that was how they found out.
Yeah, well, I didn't want to tell them. I wanted, and ironically, you know, most people hide their sex lives from their parents because they don't want them to know what they're getting up to. But I wanted my parents to think I was a little bit cooler than what I was.
Rachel, so now that we know about the sex myth, this idea that even though we're surrounded by sex, can you put the sex myth in a nutshell for us now that we've talked for an hour about it?
Yeah, normally we do this at the beginning, but let's do it at the
end. Let's do it at the end.
So I think what's at the heart of the sex myth is this idea that the way that we engage in sex really, really matters, and that it says something really central about us, so that the way that we engage with sex determines our desirability, not just in the sense of how hot we are, but in how much people desire to be around us. That it reveals whether or not our relationship is going well, or whether we're worthy of being in a relationship. That it reveals whether we're moral or we're enlightened. And this is a lot of weight to put on a single act, psychologically and emotionally. And it means that when we feel we are different when it comes to sex, that it impacts us on a kind of deeper kind of heart level.
And so what can individuals do to dismantle the sex myth now that we know about it?
I think we need to change the way that we talk about sex. We need to be a little bit more honest about our foibles and the ways in which we're not living up to the ideal. And we also need to be aware of the way that we're communicating that sex should be done in certain ways when we're talking to friends and acquaintances and colleagues, and kind of break that down.
Great takeaway. Honesty is always usually the best policy. We're talking with Rachel Hill. She's the author of The Sex Myth, The Gap Between Our Fantasies and Reality, out in paperback now by Simon & Schuster. That about does it for today's exchange. Rachel, thanks for being here.
Thank you.